Radio Drome. It's another eargasm of a Radio Drome. Yes, I just said eargasm. For those of you who care, Brad is not in this episode. We are recording this on his birthday, so he is off getting alcohol poisoning somewhere. It is myself, Alex Jowski.
Hello.
The Marquis de Suede, I should say.
Yes, I like that nickname.
We have a really awesome guest back with us, Diamanda Hagen.
Hello, everyone. Happy to be here again.
No, you're not. Don't lie to us.
Well, I'm happy to be on. I'm not really happy at the moment, but we can talk about that later on.
We'll talk about that. We got to do the Adam and Eve promo first. And right now, you could even partake in this since you're in the States at the time we're recording this.
Yeah, I am. I'm with my wife.
You go to adamandeve.com, use the promo code DROME, and you get 50% off of a single item. You get 3 free DVDs. You get U.S. shipping and a free mystery gift, all for using the promo code DROME at adamandeve.com. I've said that so many times in my life, I can almost recite that in my sleep at this point.
Do you get to choose what DVDs you get?
Nope. I think they cycle them through, but it's a set. You get these 3 this month, you get these 3 the next month, and so on. But I don't think it's the same 3, for instance, if you order a year apart. I'm not sure. And the mystery gift is literally mysterious. That's totally randomized, so I have no clue what the mystery gift is. That's not a joke.
It's something from baddragon.com. Have you ever seen baddragon.com?
No, but don't take this the wrong way. If you're recommending it, it's probably not for me.
It's my old purpose to disturb people with a link website that won't actually get them in trouble.
Because you have a much higher tolerance for this stuff than I do, Diamanda.
Bad Dragon is basically a sex toy website, but everything is based on real and imaginary animals.
Oh, so it's just creepy.
So you can have dildos that are made out of, like, cast from a dolphin's dildo, or they have, like, you know, dragon penises and things.
Yeah, that's successfully creeped me out.
Good.
That is unique.
Go to baddragon.com and find it hilarious.
Right before we started recording, you were telling me about a movie that disturbed even you. Can you tell the audience what you told me?
I literally, just before we started the call, watched a movie which is in my next season of reviews, and I was taking it for notes. I bought this movie based on the trailer, and I this was my watching it for the first time, and I was taking notes for the first time, and fuck, bleak, disturbing, fucked up, and I have a high tolerance for this shit. I watched it with my wife, and she's not watched the same stuff I've watched, so I'm genuinely a little worried.
So what was the movie?
I'll tell you actually, because in the next,
if you don't want to ruin it for next season, yeah.
Well, my next season, I'll probably announce the full lineup for my next season in the next month or so. So it is Where the Dead Go to Die. I came across it on the That Guy with the Glasses forum. Someone basically set up a thread saying someone must review this and a copy of the trailer. And I ordered the DVD within about 30 seconds of the trailer starting. I quite regret it right now. I have to make this funny.
And see, that's why you're a true professional. If you can make that funny, Diamanda, then you're a true professional.
Yeah, I did a comedy review of Slaughtered Vomit Dolls, and oh. I am worried about this.
Yeah, Slaughtered Vomit Dolls is a tough movie to watch.
I made it funny, so...
Well, but then Joe Bob Briggs made I Spit on Your Grave somehow funny. So look at it like that. That's one of the most serious and disturbing rape movies I've ever seen. And the commentary that Joe Bob gives is absolutely hilarious.
Well,
so it
one,
can't be done.
Oh, yeah, definitely can. Well, with this one, I think it'll be easier for... It's difficult. It's a CGI animated film, and the CGI does look like a PS1 game. But after a while, that stops being hilarious and starts being an actual, like, visual style. Then it starts out, haha, I can make fun of this. It just keeps going and going and going and going and going and going, and it gets harder and harder and harder. You feel your wish to live draining from you.
Yeah, I just looked up this movie on IMDb, and it sounds pretty unique.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, well, Alex, you and I haven't seen it. She has.
Yeah, the description is just...
This film, if they tried to make it in live action and they used the same angles and showed the same stuff, it would not be could not be legally released, probably. I almost want to grab the people who were freaked out by Human Centipede and or Serbian film and say, you fucking pussies!
Well, then let me ask you, if the three of us can play a little armchair psychologist here, why do people and the three of us are all in this category, and I know Brad is too, why do we seek out films like this? Why do we seek out films that are so disturbing we know they're going to stick with us?
I don't especially seek out disturbing films. Films don't tend to make me disturbed. Well, my tolerance for this used to be much lower, but in the last couple of years, it's been incredibly high. Like, I remember watching 127 Hours tonight with my wife in the cinema, and she was crying, and she was affected by the, frankly, in real life, horrible thing that was happening on screen with this guy. Because the guy had been a dickhead earlier in the film, I was laughing my head off. It takes a lot to make a film disturb me. I don't seek out disturbing. I just seek out interesting and different. Disturbing just comes along with it sometimes.
I just like movies that I could remember, because everything nowadays is kind of like the same movie over and over. And it's just so devoid of any individuality.
But okay, then let me ask this. Why do we, as a movie-going culture, why do we gravitate towards the less mundane? For instance, I'm thinking of like Fulci's Zombie, the eyeball scene. Everyone I know has shown that scene to their friends, whether they like the movie or not. So that scene clearly stuck with people, and people sought it out when they heard, hey, there's this Italian zombie movie from the late 70s where they slowly show a shard of wood going through a woman's eye. You need to see this. Wouldn't that normally be a warning to, maybe I don't want to see this?
People have a tendency to, people want to see what they're not supposed to see. They want to have what they're not supposed to have. It's just human nature when something is out of limits. And the eye, it's a bit like dentistry. It's a part of yourself that you don't like people going near. So seeing it happen to something in someone else is affecting.
When I hear about something that's so out of the norm, and let's just stick with zombie for a second. When I heard that there's a scene where a zombie fights a shark and it's not fake looking, I said, I don't think I've ever seen that on film. I really need to see that. Whereas some people go, a zombie that fights a shark, that's just dumb.
It's a zombie that fights a shark that I find more interesting, to be honest.
And I do too. For one thing, that scene is shot gorgeously. The colors, the cinematography, it's a beautifully shot scene, no matter what was happening. So there is that, and then there's the fact that I don't think I'd ever seen a zombie fight a shark before. Or since, really.
Yeah, it's. I think if Romero had managed to make his Resident Evil, because he scripted it, I think there was a scene with zombies and sharks.
Well, there was a zombie shark in the game, so that makes sense, actually.
I didn't play much Resident Evil, so.
In the first game, at one point, it's not a zombie, it's more like a mutated shark attacks you, so I could actually see that being kind of in line with the game, actually. But then, why do you think people seek out, a perfect example is a Serbian film. That movie made all of its money based on word of mouth of everybody else going, oh my god, this is the most shocking, disturbing, sick film I've ever seen. I need to show it to others, too.
Part of it is watching other people's reactions whenever you know what's going to happen.
I know for myself, I'm always drawn to the weird. When I hear about some Hollywood movie, I mean, we joke about it all the time on Geek Juice and on this show, that every movie's a cookie cutter. That, oh, it's the same plot we've seen 100 times, just this time it's got Tom Cruise in it, this time it's got Brad Pitt in it. And then whenever you do see one that is so different, you go, all right, that's different, but there are certain circumstances like World War Z, I wanted the cookie cutter movie. I wanted the movie that was in the book. I don't want the Lemmings movie that they've made. Does that make sense?
Was World War Z really a cookie cutter? If it was adapted accurately to the book, would it really have been a cookie cutter movie?
No.
No, it's a pretty unique book.
Yeah, it's a pretty unique book, but when they first said they were going to adapt it, they said it was going to have a main character, something the book does not, and it would follow the spread of the plague. Basically, it's a Romero film. I went, okay, that could still be good if it follows the overall storyline of the book. And then the trailer we got shows it's a totally different story, and it's got nothing whatsoever to do with the book. And funny enough, Brad Pitt is in total I don't want to be here mode, which I think is hilarious.
Especially considering he produced it.
Yeah, and I've heard he's not on speaking terms with the director or any of the rewriters at this point. He basically is telling him to void his contract. He's not coming back for reshoots. He's done with the movie. And I think that's fascinating. In a way, I like the story surrounding the World War Z movie better than I think I'll probably ever like the movie.
It's a bit like the 1990s Island of Dr. Moreau, then.
Yes, a movie that's not very good, but you could make a movie out of the making of that, and that would be fascinating, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah, I would love to see a whole thing about that, like a documentary or even a feature film. What happened there was insane.
Have you ever seen one of the interviews with Richard Stanley, the original director that was fired after 3 days?
Yes, I have a copy of the Criterion release of The Island of Lost Souls, and he's interviewed on that about it.
Yeah, he was basically completely screwed by weather and Val Kilmer. And Val Kilmer admitted he was so high during that movie, he doesn't remember shooting it.
Yeah, and Val Kilmer himself, it wasn't all his fault. He found out, like, the day before they were supposed to film that his wife was divorcing him. And so he demanded to be given a different part so he could leave the city early to go back to see his wife. And then you also had Marlon Brando, a guy who doesn't give a shit on the best of times. His daughter had just committed suicide whenever he was in pre-production, and like this island he owned was nuked by the French. It's a perfect storm of Jesus Christ.
Of everything that can go wrong going wrong.
Except for zombie apocalypse, yeah.
Well, then why do you think truly unique scripts, or now some of the ones I'm going to give as examples aren't very unique now, but at the time that they were proposed, these hadn't really been done to death before. Why do you think truly unique scripts get thrown at the bottom of the pile and nobody wants to produce them? For example, if they had adapted Psycho 2, the novel, instead of the Psycho 2 we got, which I liked. I loved the Psycho 2 we got. The story that Robert Block originally wanted them to make was basically a movie company is trying to make a movie out of the events of the first Psycho, and people start dying, and Norman Bates is a consultant, and he gets blamed for it. That hadn't really been done before when they started doing
Scream
3. That in the late 70s. Yes, but this is the late 70s, so don't bring Scream into this yet, DM.
I know, I can. It's similar to what was done 20 years later. I don't mean to, Scream 3 is terrible. I don't mean to insult Psycho 2, the book.
But I'm just saying, why do you think that was rejected and the studio just said, we kind of want just a remake of Psycho, but in color?
They want what's profitable. Movies are a business, so they when they discover what's profitable, they want to redo that. It's like, why does McDonald's constantly try to make all of the Big Macs very similar? You know, rather than take the chance that, you know, this crazy guy in the middle of North Dakota in a McDonald's might actually come up with a better burger if you just let him experiment on a couple of customers.
Basically, studios, they like money more than critical acclaim.
This is what happens if you do get a truly unique idea out there, or maybe not even unique, just a different take on an old idea that can really resonate with audiences, which resonates into word of mouth, which resonates to critics, which resonates into dollars.
Yeah, it can.
The way I look at it, people are sick of the this is why, like, the Friday the 13th movies had to, and I don't think I've ever used this term before with the later Friday the 13th, get creative with their plots because people weren't going to see the same movie over again. 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are basically the same movie with minor differences. Whereas for 9, they said, just screw it. Let's just go. Let's just go with whatever weird we have.
Isn't 4 the one where... Is it 4 or 5 where Jason is dead and it's this guy, this ambulance driver?
That's 5.
That's a difference. That's a difference. And then you have the body swapping one. I think that's 9.
Yeah.
And then you have Jason X in space. Well, I love Jason X. I don't think anyone else does, though.
No, I love Jason X. I've said that many a times. That movie has no right to be as good as it is.
But the reason why... people don't tend to do that is because 9 times out of 10, whenever you get creative or do something weird, it will either not hit critically or commercially, and the company would rather stick with something that they know will make money rather than something might hit it big or will probably not. I wish that they didn't think like this, but they do.
A perfect example, Halloween. Halloween 3 tried to do something radically different. I love the film. And then they just said, that didn't work. Just go back to Michael Myers. And that's disappointing. Even though I like Halloween 4 a lot, it was disappointing that, like the new Halloween 3, I don't think take the same direction that they are. It's just going to be another Michael Myers movie.
Are they doing another Halloween 3, reboot? I thought Rob Zombie's one had pretty much...
Oh, no, it's being done by Todd Farmer and what's his face?
It's being written by the guy that wrote Jason X and Drive Angry, so that actually encourages me a little bit because.
And from the director of Drive Angry and My Bloody Valentine.
Because I loved Jason X and Drive Angry, so I'm behind Todd Farmer on this one.
Is it a reboot? Is it a continuation of the original? Is it a sequel to Rob Zombies?
It's a sequel to Rob Zombies, but they haven't released any details other than that. All we know is it's a Michael Myers story again.
My worry with whenever they reboot horror long-running franchises, you know, whether this be James Bond, Star Trek, or Friday the 13th, whatever, basically, whenever the reboot runs out of steam with its sequels, when it won't continue, they'll just reboot it again in an attempt to get more money and give it back.
Spider-Man!
There you go. The Amazing Spider-Man shouldn't have been an origin story.
Or even the new Superman movie, Man of Steel, it's not called Superman. Okay, Superman Returns sucked, I give you that, but this one's not a sequel to that, it's the origin story again.
Yeah, with some superhero movies, you need to have the origin story because they're not famous. You know, Superman, Spider-Man, Batman don't need it, we all fucking know.
Exactly. Now, I understand, like, with the X-Men, prior to the movie, the general public didn't know them, I get that. I hate when a movie takes an origin we already know. Such as Superman. I think everyone, you could go to the jungles of Uganda and show a picture of Superman to a kid in the street and they'd know who it was and that he is the last son of Krypton and he gets his powers from the sun and Ma and Pa Kent. You don't need to waste an entire movie showing his origin again and how he, you know, embraces who Superman is. That's just pointless.
Why studios don't take chances with original movies? They let the independents do that, and when that independent original movie makes a lot of money, the studios are right there to make the exact same amount of money ripping it off four or five times.
Which is why when I do see it, something really, even if it's not original, like I brought up before, if it's just a unique take or something I haven't seen before, such as Drive Angry. Drive Angry was not like a lot of the movies that it was sold as, because that movie... I don't recall in the first trailer even knowing that it was a supernatural film.
Me neither. I thought it was just a car movie.
Yeah, and then you find out that there's all this hell and William Fichtner stealing every scene, and you go, this was not like anything else that was out at the time. That was a good thing.
And it lost money.
Of course, yes, it lost money, because it was different.
Yeah, this is why I review the movies I review. I genuinely want to expand what people... films people get in contact with, whether, you know, I genuinely hope that no matter how terrible the movie I just reviewed is, I want someone to be so interested in the subject matter based on my thing that they go off and buy it. You know, I reviewed Nixon and Hogan Smoke Christmas, which is a film by Kevin Strange. He did a little movie. He's retired from filmmaking, writing books now, but he told me, because basically I have limited contact with him, I gave his YouTube account in my review and said, told people to go on, you know, contact him to buy his movies. Cause, you know, I got a deal, $50 for his entire set of movies and a t-shirt. Nice. And he contacted me later on to say that he managed to fund like two or three trips to conventions to horror conventions to sell his books based on the DVDs that he sold because of me.
That's
and
awesome.
It's wonderful.
Yes. That's awesome for both you and him. The namesake that this show takes it from, Videodrome. Wholly original film. In 1982, this film was ahead of its time, and it was a bomb at the box office. It was a bomb on home video. It had some of the most negative test screenings of Universal Pictures, but it was so shockingly different, it eventually found its voice, and it's made its money back now on video. But why do you think Universal, in all honesty, I'm surprised Universal backed this movie back in 81 when it was being shot. I really am.
Could have something to do with just the fact that, you know, it's Cronenberg being Cronenberg. You just give him a budget and let him do what he wants.
But he wasn't really a big name then. I mean, he'd only had Scanners, which was a minor, you know, relative hit. And he had Rabbit and Shivers. He hadn't done The Brood or anything yet.
Scanners has two sequels, so it must have made at least a decent amount of money back.
No, Scanners has four sequels. There was a spinoff series called Scanner Cop and Scanner Cop 2. That are set in the same universe. So that actually has five movies in that franchise.
Well, Scanners must have made a decent amount of money then. So maybe they just saw, Scanners, this is profitable enough to get sequels. So here you go, David Cronenberg, do something weird.
It could be, but then the test audience cards, the test audience cards for Videodrome are hilarious to read. Somebody found one of them in some old vault at Universal and posted them online.
What did they say?
They were saying things like, I can't respect any movie studio that would release garbage like this. This is the worst film I've ever seen. I've never seen such vile filth. Every single card, Universal said up to this point in their history, they had never had this negative of a reaction to one of their movies before.
Did they recruit their test audiences from local churches or something?
It shocks me when I see something like Videodrome. I still am shocked that that movie ever came out.
Well, once you've made it, unless you're going to spend a fuckload more on trying to remake it or change massive parts of it, you might as well just release it. If they figure they've got a massive bomb, they've probably figured that reshooting parts of it or re-editing it is not going to make it any better.
But then look at House of a Thousand Corpses. House of a Thousand Corpses was made, I believe it was either Universal or Paramount. I think Universal for them, and the test screenings were so awful. They basically sat on the film for almost 3 years before Rob Zombie could gather enough money of his own to buy the movie back from them, when then he gave it to Lionsgate and it became a huge hit.
Did they ever release the uncut House of a Thousand Corpses? Because I have a cut version.
I don't know if I've got it on DVD. I don't know if that's cut or uncut. It's pretty damn gory, but I never actually looked at the rating to know what version that was.
Because I know the version I've got, I didn't think much of it, but I did like Devil's Reject, so.
See, to me, with House of a Thousand Corpses, I didn't like the story, I didn't like the characters, except for Sid Haig. He stole every scene he was in. I liked what Zombie was trying to do. I liked his direction in it. I liked the camera angles, the cinematography, the filters, the editing. I just thought he forgot to write the goddamn thing. It's like he just came up with it after a weekend of watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1 and 2 over and over and said, I'll just do that.
Yeah, and if you're going to basically copy something that, I thought it was like a not as good sort of version of 2001 Maniacs, the remake of 2000 Maniacs.
Oh, I haven't seen the remake of that. Is that the one with Robert Englund?
Yeah, it's.
Yeah, it's good. Its sequel is terrible.
Okay,
they made a 2002 Maniacs, I think is what they called the sequel to the remake.
Oh, God.
No, it was 2001 Maniacs: Field of Screams.
Oh, that's what it was. So
that's even dumber.
And Bill Moseley plays the mayor. It might have actually been an okay film, but unfortunately, they had almost literally no budget. It was probably made for about $20,000.
Even for direct to video, that's low.
And it's the same director. It's got Bill Moseley. It's got Ogre from Skinny Puppy, I think. It's got its cast and sort of people behind it are way too good for the budget that they had.
Bill Moseley does that a lot. The way Joe Dante put it on the commentary for The Howling when he's talking about John Carradine, he said John Carradine, always a workman. He never half-assed it, no matter how bad or low budget the movie was. But he said John Carradine said yes to a lot of movies he should not have. And I see that with Bill Moseley today. I think Bill Moseley is an incredibly talented actor. And I see him in such garbage that I just have to ask myself, really? Was Rent due? I mean, why are you in this, Bill?
He sort of vanished for a long time. He appears in the weirdest places, like Army of Darkness. It's like it's probably like the fourth or fifth viewing before you'll notice him.
Yeah, because I think he tried to retire for Sid Haig did the same thing until Tarantino pulled him out of retirement for the cameo in Jackie Brown. He's the judge that sentences Jackie at the very beginning.
I didn't realize that.
You didn't realize
him.
That was Sid Haig? You didn't realize
no.
That Sid Haig is the judge?
Did not realize it. I knew he retired for a while because I saw all the stuff he did in the 70s and then all the stuff he did in the late 90s. So I knew there was a period where he didn't make anything.
Yeah, he retired. Tarantino got him out of retirement to do that little cameo. And since he and Pam Grier had worked together in all those blaxploitation films, they'd worked together on like a good 7 movies in the 70s together. She didn't know he was playing the judge and she blew the first take when she saw him and she just started laughing.
That's cool. That's like the most unexpected judge cameo since Larry Flint turned up in The People versus Larry Flint to get himself for obscenity.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, Larry Flint sentencing Larry Flint to prison. But you even have, and with all the crap I give Tarantino. Everyone knows how I love Jackie Brown. I'm really surprised a movie like Jackie Brown got made. Look at what films were like in 1997. You weren't making the 70s throwback kind of movie hadn't leached its way into mainstream Hollywood. I can't think of another film of that era, probably 2 or 3 years on either side, that was like Jackie Brown. And no, I don't think Pulp Fiction was. Pulp Fiction to me is not a 70s throwback.
It's a 50s throwback.
Yeah, it's very different, but it's not what the style Jackie Brown brought to it. Jackie Brown honestly feels more 2000s than it does 97 to me.
Tarantino had just come off of Pulp Fiction, and he didn't make another film after Jackie Brown for about 5 years. So I think he put a lot of his cachet into his clout into making Jackie Brown, and that's why he had trouble making another movie. That's what I think. And because Jackie Brown was a big flop, wasn't it?
Yeah, Jackie Brown was a big flop. But I think some of the original casting decisions would have been different. Samuel L. Jackson's part was originally written for James Earl Jones.
That would have been
a radically different movie, I think. And there was a couple of, I think Bruce Willis was originally cast for Robert De Niro's part.
What about, didn't Michael Keaton's character in that turn up in a couple other films around then as well?
He played the same character in Out of Sight. And even though it wasn't played by Michael Keaton, his character is in the first episode of the Karen Sisko TV series, but he's played by Peter Horton in that.
Well, because they're the same character, and they're both from Elmore Leonard books.
Yeah, because all the Elmore Leonard books are interlinked, such as there's another Elmore Leonard book that has the Robert De Niro and Samuel L. Jackson characters in it when they're still in prison, when they're first getting to know each other. They're side characters in another one of Elmore Leonard's books. So all his stuff is connected.
The Tarantino verse is getting incredibly complicated.
When you bring the Elmore Leonard verse into it, yes.
Do you hear I read a theory ages ago about the Tarantino verse, that there's actually two Tarantino verses. You've got the real world, which is like Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. And the real world is Inglourious Basterds there as well. Inglourious Basterds changed history, so that created the Tarantino-verse. But then films like From Dusk Till Dawn and Death Proof and Kill Bill are actually films in that world. Kill Bill is an adaptation of the Fox Force 5, I think it was called, from Pulp Fiction, that was mentioned with Uma Thurman's character had been in a pilot. That's that Kill Bill is meant to be a film adaptation of that show she was in, but made for the big screen in that universe. It's really complicated.
Well, and then you also got to think that also pulls in Natural Born Killers and True Romance as well, which are movies he didn't direct but were his scripts, if you really want to get complicated like that.
Yeah, it's the person said that the general rule of thumb is that if the film's more insane, then it's going to be a film inside of the universe rather than a real events. Natural Born Killers is an interesting one. I know Tarantino wrote it and Oliver Stone directed it. But watching it, it feels to me much more like an Oliver Stone script directed by Quentin Tarantino than the other way around.
Oliver Stone heavily rewrote the script. Tarantino actually tried to have his name removed from the final version of Natural Born Killers because, in his words, Oliver Stone screwed his script up, which I disagree. I've read Tarantino's script, and it wasn't bad. So I'm not bashing Tarantino for that. It was not a bad script. It was a lot more chaotic, and I know that's saying something with Natural Born Killers. And it didn't have some of the social satire. All the social satire of the media, that really came in heavy in Stone's rewrites. And that's one of the things I loved about Natural Born Killers.
Oh, it's a brilliant film. It's one of Stone's best and one of Tarantino's best.
And it's one of the last pre-insanity Oliver Stone movies, too.
Out of the films he did since then, I haven't seen Savages. But
Brad told me how terrible Savages is, and on that one I'm deferring to Brad's judgment.
Well, you know, when it comes to Oliver Stone movies, I like Alexander. I own 3 copies of it on 3 different cuts, and they're making a 4th cut, and I'm going to buy it on DVD.
That's one I haven't seen. I haven't seen Alexander, but I despise World Trade Center. I thought U-Turn was absolutely horrendous. I thought Stone just kind of lost his mind as the 90s went on.
Well, World Trade Center was okay. It didn't feel like an Oliver Stone movie. U-Turn, I can't really recall. I've seen it. It didn't leave much of a mark on me. But apart from loving Alexander, apart from that, Natural Born Killers probably was his last great film.
I'd agree with that. And I thought Tarantino's script for True Romance was again, that was very unique. That was something, because True Romance was what, 93, I think that was made? Maybe 94?
Something like that, yeah.
Tarantino was trying something different. I actually really would have liked, the fans are going to go crazy because of I give all this crap to Tarantino, but at the same time, I wonder how different something like True Romance would have been had it not been Tony Scott directing it. And if it had been Tarantino directing his own script for True Romance. Because I think True Romance is one of the best action movies of the 90s.
If you notice that there was something interesting, you know, you got these comments, you know, things about, you know, what would these scripts have been like if you had someone else had directed them. Quentin Tarantino offered Terry Gilliam the script to either Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction before it was made. He was at Cannes and he was hanging around. He met Terry Gilliam by just chance, and he gave the script to Terry Gilliam. Terry Gilliam said it was, and Terry Gilliam said he thought it was really, really good, but he shouldn't direct it. And if you look, Terry Gilliam is thanked in the credits of Reservoir Dogs for giving encouragement just to keep trying.
And I think that's good, because while I don't like Pulp Fiction, it's not a movie I like at all, I respect what it did. And see, all my problems with Tarantino come from the fact that I don't think the man has yet made, and I'm talking about the movies he's directed, an original film. When everything he does is a reference to something else, an homage to something else, or the characters talking about another movie, you're not an original filmmaker. That's where my issue comes in. And of course, Reservoir Dogs, it's a blatant ripoff, but I absolutely love it. And people give me crap over that dichotomy all the time. Did you ever watch The Critic, Diamanda? Did you guys get that show over there?
I've heard of The Critic, and I know he turned up in The Simpsons, but I haven't seen any episodes. I tried to get a hold of some to watch, but I haven't managed to so far.
The whole series is available over here. You can get it really easy. Otherwise, I can send them to you online later. But there was one episode where Jay Sherman, he's basically an ultra-cynical cinema snob parody of what Roger Ebert would be. He goes to Hollywood and he gets hired as a screenwriter, and they want him to write Ghost Chasers 3. He has this really original script that the studio executive is like, this is so good, we can't possibly make it. And he throws it on this pile in like a sealed vault of all the scripts that are too good to ever really be made into movies.
Oh, like
not that bad of a parody, you know?
Like Barton Fink. He spends the entire film he's a novelist and he tries to write a script for a wrestling movie in the 50s. And when he finally finishes it, he gives it to them and they're like, we can't fucking make this. This is good. This is like too good. I wanted you to make some right swing shit. He then goes insane and John Goodman runs around and there's this fire. It's great.
Well, cause I've seen that kind of thing parodied all the time where quality gets pushed aside for quantity. And like right now, and keep in mind, I have not seen The Hobbit and Unexpected Journey Part 1. How does a book that's barely 300 pages get made into 9 hours of film?
They're doing a bridge. Like, the third movie isn't really based on The Hobbit. It's based off of other things Tolkien wrote to kind of bridge together the two books.
Well, no, actually, not quite. It's rather than doing one movie that's a bridge, they're doing. They've taken the story of The Hobbit, which would have probably been about 3 hours, and they have added a fuckload from the appendices of Lord of the Rings, the Silmarillion, a bunch of other things that they have the rights to, basically to turn The Hobbit into another Lord of the Rings, which I'm fine with. I saw The Hobbit, the first part, in 48 frames, and I thought the 48 frames is interesting, but as a film, I thought it was up there with the other Lord of the Rings movies.
See, I'm on Brad's side. I didn't like those. I mean, you know, I'm not diminishing anyone if they enjoy the Hobbitverse, but those movies are not made for me. I didn't enjoy Lord of the Rings or Two Towers, never saw Return of the King, because why would I see the third one if I didn't like the first two? And I just have no interest. To me, The Hobbit was already made into a great movie in 1977.
Yeah, but that didn't feature the Seventh Doctor.
No, it didn't.
Don't agree.
Sylvester McCoy is the whole reason I'm going to go watch The Hobbit. Once I found out about that, I was sold.
Nerd.
Yeah, it's I really enjoyed The Hobbit. The 48 frames is fascinating. It's the some of it, I'm not sure. You know, they do have like it does make people's actions look a bit unnatural at times, and that sort of improved as the film went on. I don't know if my eyes adjusted. It's definitely going to force if people do it more often to improve the craftsmanship of filmmaking. It's going to force the makeup to be better, sets to be better, and it'll be like, you know, the upgrading from VHS to DVD. It's like you watch on shows on DVD that were made, like I watched Star Trek Deep Space Nine on DVD, and the makeup is really obvious. It's like that. You can see where the makeup joins, and it's going to force them to be better makeup artists, and I'm for that.
But I don't think, in your Deep Space Nine example, I don't think you can hold something made back in 1993, made for standard definition and made for television, to be held to the same standards that, say, the new J.J. Abrams makeup in those films.
Oh, I'm not. I'm just. It's like watching something that is made with regular film makeup. Watching it in 48 frames is similar to watching something made for VHS on DVD. The problems with the image are noticeable. Like, people have commented on the Hobbit feet being bad in the movie. I didn't notice that. I noticed the fake ears that Martin Freeman was wearing as Bilbo. They were pretty much as obvious as the 1990 Captain America ones. Because this is the first 48 frames big feature film, they haven't got the hang of changing how they do things to accommodate the 48 frames. So you can see these problems in the film. Steadicam operators are trained to work at a particular speed and, thing to get smoothness at 24 frames a second. At 48 frames, Steadicam work looks choppy. It looks, there's problems with it. And they're going to have to retrain Steadicam operators. It's just fascinating to watch this big feature film. The deficiencies in filmmaking are just blown up so big. Personally, I hope they continue with the 48 frames because it is better quality. It's just interesting to see a film with its flaws so obvious because of it.
It almost seems like what you're talking about is you kind of lose the old style of filmmaking after a while. For instance, have you ever listened to the commentary for Young Frankenstein?
No, I haven't, but I'm not a big fan of Young Frankenstein, so I don't own it on DVD.
Basically, when Mel Brooks made that movie, black and white had been... Nobody had made a big-budget black and white movie in 15, 20 years at that point. So when he wanted to shoot it black and white, he ran into one of the problems that Tarantino did with Kill Bill, where he shot the whole movie in color and then tinted it black and white. You have to light black and white different than you light than color film. None of his crew on Young Frankenstein knew how to light a black and white film. He had to go dig out all the old Universal veterans who had been retired for 20 years to teach his crew how to light for black and white. It's like that the art of that had completely been lost. And that's one of the problems I have with the black and white in Kill Bill. It was clearly color tinted later because I look at cinematography and you can tell that that's not lit right. That's not lit like a black and white film should be.
Yeah, to evoke the... Well, it depends. Was Tarantino going for the... to evoke the black and white look of old films, or was he going for a more modern black and white look? Because whenever the lighting back then was different from the lighting now, so it's... Was he deliberately going for the old style look, or was he not trying to go for it? Because the lighting would depend on that. Young Frankenstein, he definitely wanted a Universal 30s look, but Tarantino, I'm not sure if he was really going for that.
I don't know. I don't know what his motivations were for. I just noticed when I saw it in the theater, it was one of those things that bugged me. Because to go back to the Howling commentary, Joe Dante says there are two types of color movies. Movies that happen to be in color and color movies. And he likes to make color movies. That's why you always see Joe Dante with all these great red and blue and green lights all over the place. Because he wants to exploit the fact that you're making a color movie and not just making a movie that happens to be in color.
Yeah, that's a little bit like my philosophy for when I do my review show. I exploit the fact that I have access to interesting lighting alterations I can do in post-production. And so I interesting the fuck out of my footage.
Right. And I have no problem with that. But have you ever run into when you're doing that, you'll notice it doesn't quite look right because the lighting when you were initially shooting is not quite right for, say, the green filter you wanted to add, just as an example?
Well, I don't really add filters. It's a bit of a different than that. But in the early days, okay, the first review I did, I don't know how I managed it, but I was in a fully lit room. And I managed to do some light alterations to it, and it made me perfectly lit, and everything behind me was black. People who watched it thought I filmed it in a dark room. And then I spent the next 6 episodes trying to recreate that and failing, so eventually I decided I'm just going to do something different every time based on the lighting conditions I have. So all of my episodes tend to look different because I just deal with what I've got.
And I think that's adding a uniqueness to it. That also, it goes back to, it's kind of becoming a lost art on just altering it in post rather than, like you said, you were using whatever lighting conditions you happen to have the day you're shooting.
Well, I'm when I got back to after Magfest, I'm going to be in a new filming location for a while, and then I'm moving to a new location. But my original location, which I've used in most of my episodes, I have a light above me, and there's a light that comes from the side because there are no curtains in that room. So depending of when I film, like daytime or nighttime, that affects it. And where I try to stay in the same place for the filming, but I don't always manage it. So that's the main factors.
I've got two lights to the side of me and one that's like behind the camera pointed at me. That took me a while to position because there's some episodes where I've got shadows behind me, until it took me a while to figure out just where it was, to where the shadow was exactly behind me and never showed up.
Like I said about like the young Frankenstein thing, you forget how to, like Diamanda, you were bringing up how 48 frame will eventually take over.
Well, I don't know if it will. I want to see film expanded. You know, I don't think that any particular type of filmmaking should be destroyed or got rid of. I would like to see it be used more often because I think it's more interesting than 3D. You know, I'm not a big fan of 3D. Whenever you can watch it without having to use 3D glasses, I'll be happy. But till then, I can live without it.
Just wait. You're a lot younger. Did you ever see one of the old red and blue movies in 3D?
Yes, I think it's like Final Destination 4. It came in on DVD. The DVD box came with the 3D version and the regular version, and they came with the red and green, red and blue glasses.
Because I saw Space Hunter, Adventures in the Forbidden Zone, Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, Return of the Creature, and a couple of other movies in 3D back in the 80s. I mean, you think modern 3D gives you a headache? Try watching an 80s movie in the theater
I've actually never got a headache from 3D. It's just something that it just generally it annoys me to a certain extent. You know, it's always you've got things coming towards you. What I would really like to see, if they're going to do 3D, I want to see it so that you're seeing further in the background, so that it's not just stuff approaching you, it's stuff going away from you as well. I don't think I've ever seen a film where it does that properly. But one of the good things about The Hobbit, because especially in the scenes out in nature, it did look like you were literally looking through the cinema at a scene outside, and so therefore the 3D looked a lot more natural than most things.
That's actually one of the complaints that I've heard. I've heard both film critics and just general audiences complain that the movie, when you see it at that high frame rate, it doesn't feel like a movie anymore, and it feels like a newscast. And they said, I just want to see a movie. I don't want it to seem so realistic. It seems like I'm just off camera.
To be perfectly frank, a lot of the people making that complaint, they're just used to the way that things are. There's no there's no objective better or worse. There's just what you're used to and what's new. It's like, I'm sure people said something similar whenever they moved from like 16 frames to 24 frames. You know, technology evolves.
This is going to shock everybody. I'm not against technology evolving. I'm against everyone throwing out the old technology immediately. For instance, like how quickly VHS was thrown aside for DVD. I embraced DVD. I've got tons of DVDs. I love DVD. DVD overtook VHS in only 7 years, what it took VHS the 30 years to build to. That to me was a little quick of just going, we're not even doing VHS anymore. This is just over.
If I had more space and money, I would love to. I still got some VHSs. I would love to have a lot more if I had more space and money, because honestly, some things look better in VHS to my mind, like horror movies. You know, you can lose a lot of the when the image is slightly fuzzier. Horror movies, you can hide their problems a lot easier. Like, you know, things look darker. The joins in makeup and stuff are less obvious. And sitcoms look better on VHS, I think, because the quality it looks less like it's on a set.
You've got the same thing with the 80s syndicated American stuff. A lot of that stuff was shot on either 16mm or on videotape. Look at like the first season of Star Trek: The Next Generation, or Friday the 13th, the series, or Good God, Freddy's Nightmares. Those look horrendous on DVD. Like you were talking about Deep Space Nine, how it just exemplified all the flaws. This, it's not so much the flaws, it's just this, the shot on videotape does not translate properly to digital. And I'm talking shot on a videotape 80s, does not translate properly to video. The episodes look horrible on DVD, and I've even pulled out for my War of the Worlds DVDs. I went and pulled out my original off-airs from 1988. My off-airs off VHS are cleaner copies than the official releases. That, to me, is a sad statement.
Well, that might be because they didn't convert it properly. It might just be a very bad conversion. When it comes to looking at different types of quality of image, for instance, most of the people who know who I am, who listen to this, will know I'm a Doctor Who fan. I like classic Doctor Who. And the 60s Doctor Who is when the series looked best. You know, the image quality did not get any better, worse. The special effects and shit did not get any worse between the 60s and the 80s, but it looks much better in the 60s because it's black and white. And they filmed it for black and white. And black and white hides a lot of technical problems that you have in your film.
Since we got to wind this down, your final thoughts, since this isn't even the topic I'd planned. I just wanted to talk about the psychology of the weird stuff, and we got into a far more interesting area as we went along. Where do you think, Diamanda, that things are going with the success of The Hobbit? Do you think 48's going to take over, or do you think it'll just kind of be there for the real high end, the Peter Jacksons, the James Camerons, the Ridley Scotts?
I'm not sure it has been a success so far. A lot of people don't like it. However, Hobbit 2 and 3 are being done in it as well, and Bryan Singer commented that he wants to direct X-Men Days of Future Past in the same way. So it could go either way. It could be a paradigm shift. It probably won't be. It'll probably be like 70mm. After a few people make it, it'll be brought out every so often by a director who really wants to, who has some clout, you know, like, Kenneth Branagh was the first guy in like 15 years to make a movie in 70mm footage with his Hamlet. I think it'll just be there as an extra tool in the toolbox.
Maybe, maybe not. There's a lot of resistance to it right now. I think it'll be like 3D is now. It works for some movies, but it has its place.
Unfortunately, if it's like 3D now, then that means it's going to fall into the wrong hands and it's going to be exploited in ridiculous manners, such as how 3D, everything's coming out in 3D today. Post-conversion 3D, I think, is one of the worst things that's happened since CGI.
Oh, yeah. But not every movie is in 3D. And there's certain movies that 3D doesn't work with, and nobody even thinks about putting them in 3D because it essentially still has its place, being for just the big action movies. You're not going to see a Nicholas Sparks movie in 3D.
I hope not.
Yeah, 3D should be limited to films that were filmed in 3D or possibly animated films which can be easily and cleanly converted. If you haven't filmed it in 3D, you should leave it alone.
Phantom Menace would be a perfect example.
Well, it's some of the most
useless, some of the most useless 3D ever.
It's nearly animated.
Well, yeah, it is almost animated too. But all that basically happened was the only things that really came out in 3D were the subtitles and the credits. That was about the only thing that worked.
Well, I think I might be on a different page than you with when it comes to what you want from 3D. Like, I'm not a big fan of the gimmicky shit flying at you sort of.
And see, but that's 3D. The era I came from. I came from the gimmicky shit flying at the camera era. So that's what I think 3D should be, because there is an age difference here. So, you know, if you've never seen Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone in 3D, you know, you're not getting the same movie I saw in 1983.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to be able to see the same movie you saw in 1983 anyway, because we've had such different lives leading up to it, and the time is different, where everyone's going to see the movie slightly differently. It's just, you know, neither of us are right or wrong about it. My preference for 3D is just to make it look more real.
I disagree with it, but I don't fault you for it.
Yeah, and Brad would agree with you.
Brad probably would agree with
probably.
You. Brad and I don't agree on a lot, especially lately, but he'd probably agree with me on that one. So
now, I'm quite sure I've heard him comment in reviews that he prefers gimmicky 3D. He loves his William Castle.
So unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank Diamanda for stopping by again. We can only usually grab you when you're in the States. So next time you're in the States, let me know. But where can people see the videos that you've talked about?
Well, if you want to watch, a lot of mine are available on thatguywiththeglasses.com, along with a lot of other talented people's videos. I don't say other talented people. They're the talented ones. But if you want to watch my stuff, my site, it's theamandahagen.wordpress.com, where I'm gimmicky and yelly, and I talk about movies.
What about you, Jowski, even though everybody already knows and nobody cares?
Oh, that's kind of mean. GeekTruthMedia.com.
Right now, my website is gone because of the Vietnamese again. So you can only find me at GeekJuiceMedia.com, but you can find all my shows there and my weekly column and my monthly column and blah, blah, blah. You know all this. Good night.
Trouble begins in the light.